This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Kevin Pina continues his drumbeat reporting from the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince, as hundreds of thousands of people remain without basic medical care, food, or water, as U.S. troops undermine relief efforts. Plus, Andres Tomas Contreras reports from Tegucigalpa in Honduras as President Zelaya prepares to leave the Brazilian embassy, where he has been in exile for 129 days. Also, we pay tribute to legendary historian, dissident, and truth-teller Howard Zinn, who passed away on Wednesday at the age of 87. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
We just managed to reach Kevin Pina on the ground in Port-au-Prince. So, Pierre, let me say goodbye to you, say thank you, let people know how important your work is with the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, and people can find out a lot more information by going to HaitiAction.net. We now go to Port-au-Prince. Kevin Pina, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Dennis.
Thanks for getting back to us. Kevin, are you in Port-au-Prince now?
Yes, I am. I'm up in Ketchumville, which also has a lot of damage. I went to several other neighborhoods today. I actually went to Leogan as well, which is a town south about, 40 miles. It also suffered severe damage. I went into the hospitals there, visited with patients. Was there when there were several distribution sites operating from the United Nations. And also the road at one point was blocked by people who were demonstrating because they hadn't received any aid. So it's very sporadic, and I think that the relief effort is very disorganized. The UN is doing one thing. The U.S. Marines are doing another thing. All of the different NGOs are doing their own thing. There's a bit of confusion there on the ground, and I think that what's happening is that the Haitian people are suffering as a result. And this, of course, is the second wave of the relief following the initial wave, which was the militarization of the effort by the Obama administration.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with our special correspondent, Kevin Pina, on the ground in Port-au-Prince. Do we hear now that some commerce is taking place? There is some beginning of activity on the street. How would you assess the situation now, Kevin, in terms of what's going on? What are some of the people telling you that you met, and where this thing is going right now?
Well, I mean, commerce never really stopped. People here are too poor to stop commerce. The Timashan, the little marketplace women, and the people who sell things on the side of the road, that never stopped. And, of course, part of the scandal was that all of the people who are homeless, who have nothing but the shirts on their back, have yet to really receive any significant food or water. Little bits here and there, and then nothing that seems to be really organized or involving the community leaders who are also part of the encampments. Sorry, cut out there for a second.
Okay, go on, Kevin. We're with you.
Part of the encampment. Well, the business never really stops, and of course, people with no money have had to buy water and buy food. Which is part of the scandal of all of this. What I'm hearing here is a lot of discontent, with the Preval government. There's a lot of people who just, quite frankly, can't understand why there are so many Marines and more United Nations forces in the country with arms brandished. There's a greater UN presence, and usually when they're driving through with the APVs, their guns are pointed at the crowds of Haitians on the streets. The U.S. Marines are a little more reserved about it, respectful about it, but still they're there with these big guns, and Haitians are sort of scratching their heads. Well, what kind of relief is this? Why is there such a military presence? I've begun seeing graffiti that's popping up all over the capital that says down with the occupation, down with the second occupation, of course referring to this being another United States military occupation, the first having been the longest in U.S. history, which was for 19 years, from 1915 to 1934. That's a reference to that. That graffiti is popping up all over the place. I think that there's a sense of by people people that their country's been taken over, that the Haitian government no longer controls it, that the aid effort is in confusion, that they don't know how to interface with them and their leaders, that the NGOs are competing with one another. I mean, an example is the General Hospital. And there are surgeons from all over the world that have flown in, but it seems as if somebody's an orthopedic surgeon, and there are already orthopedic surgeons who are in the operating room in the OR, they don't want to do other kinds of work. They think it's beneath them, so they end up just sitting around. So there seems to be no real effort to coordinate person power. It seems as if there's a lot of duplication of effort. If you go into the general dispensary or the pharmacy, the general hospital, it's in utter disarray and chaos. I was with a medical delegation today that actually tried to donate morphine, which is so precious here. They're giving operations without proper painkillers. And morphine is so precious, they couldn't even leave it. They were so uncomfortable with the disorganization inside of the pharmacy of the general hospital. They decided that they would dispense it to doctors that they knew personally, or that they made contact with personally who were going to be doing operations. They would offer it. So that's just small examples of what's going on here on the ground.
And we heard we spoke with Laura Flynn from the Aristide Foundation, and they managed to fly some supplies in on a plane coming out of Miami or Florida. The plane was allowed to land in the airport that's controlled by the military, but they don't have the slightest idea where the aid is, and they can't get it out of the airport. Is this now still a typical problem?
Absolutely. There are many, many civilian relief organizations that are having the same problem. It seems as if a lot of the aid is disappearing and is ending up in another particular organization's warehouse who is denying it. I can't confirm it, so I'm not going to say who, but let's just say it's a famous hip-hop artist who has a relief organization that's working here. It seems as if a lot of relief has ended up in his warehouse, according to some other relief agencies, and they've identified cartons and crates with their marks on them in those other warehouses, and they're unable, people are unable to do anything about it. There seems to be some preference going on behind the scenes here as to where the aid is going, to which organizations are going to be allowed on the ground to distribute it and to work with aid. Those groups that are bringing in aid are complaining that they're not able to find their shipments. It is a common problem that I've heard here.
The head of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, has again called for sort of a Marshall Plan. He said at one point, my belief is that Haiti, which has been incredibly hit by different things, the food and fuel crisis, the hurricane, then the earthquake, he didn't talk about the coup, it needs something that is big. This is Dominic Strauss-Kahn. Your response?
Well, yeah, it needs something that's big. It needs, I can tell you that what it really needs is a change from the bottom up, meaning that the way that business has been done here, the way that billions of dollars were already spent before this devastation created by the earthquake on January the 12th, people were already complaining, people were already going hungry. People do not have confidence in the Preval administration to manage this crisis or to make certain that aid reaches them. They have already lost confidence, I believe, in the United Nations. Most people I speak to do not have confidence in that organization. Again, they don't know what to think about the United States Marines and their heavy military presence here. Yeah, something big needs to happen, but what they have in mind, I don't think is the same that the Haitian people have in mind.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. I'm Dennis Bernstein. The reverberations of the recent 7.0 earthquake in Haiti are still being felt, along with the aftershocks. Medical teams are now reporting a growing caseload of diarrhea amongst survivors and cases of tetanus and measles. Doctors Without Borders are saying that the psychological impact of the earthquake upon its victims is becoming a lot more apparent. Thousands of patients have undergone amputations or other surgeries and are in critical need of post-operative care. Meanwhile, the U.S. military, while offering some aid, is continuing to run interference and undermining serious aspects of the rescue, and hundreds of thousands of Haitians remain homeless with no protection from the elements. Joining us from Port-au-Prince is our special correspondent, Kevin Pina. Kevin, welcome back.
Thank you, Dennis.
All right. Why don't you give us an overview of what you've been seeing over the last couple of days? What does it look like on the ground now?
Well, it's absolutely terrible. It's very, very difficult to describe the suffering of people who are forced to sleep in the dirt with no food, no water, no proper sanitation, growing concerns of disease, and, of course, aid just not being properly distributed. There seems to be a very strong disconnect between not only the civilian relief organizations, but especially USAID and the Marines, to control distribution of USAID food and water and the communities. What they're trying to do now is the communities are trying to organize themselves, identify leaders within the camps. Remember, there are more than 200,000 people who are homeless in this capital. I know that papers in the United States have been reporting 1 million homeless, but remember that this is a capital that had 2 million people. I estimate, and community leaders estimate, between 200 to 250,000 people are homeless, and they do not have proper medical attention. They do not have proper food. They don't have water, and the situation's growing increasingly desperate every day. And it seems that the main reason is that the aid organizations and the United States government and the international community are afraid of the very community that they claim they are trying to serve. Why? Because the community leaders say that they are lavalas, that they're outside of the process. So today I met with several community leaders who are trying to organize, identify other community leaders with many of the great camps, the huge camps that have formed around the capital, and to pull them together into a meeting to then begin to negotiate with the international community and the United Nations and the U.S. government to say, look, we can handle this aid distribution. We can control our own people. You don't need to be afraid of us. What's most important to us is that they don't die of starvation, that they don't die of dehydration. I mean, I can tell you I've been personally affected by this. In one of the camps that I'm close to, two babies, one of them 3 years old and one of them 6 years old, died of dehydration. We did everything we could to try to get water to that community, and no one would listen. And again, I can't explain it any other way except that they're afraid of them. And the militarization of this relief effort has not helped. And I think that that's clearly an example of the approach of the United States government and of the international community towards these people.
All right, Kevin, say a little bit. Well, let me just ask you this. There are several concerning, several issues that are of grave concern. Among them, the fact that there are now outbreaks of diarrhea and tetanus. These are things that people were concerned about. And we're seeing now that those who have gone through amputations, thousands who have had surgeries and amputations, are now desperately in need of post-operative care, and they aren't getting it. Tell us about what that looks like on the ground.
Well, one of the problems is, of course, that there are tons of doctors who have entered, and that's a wonderful thing. But unfortunately, most of them want to work in their own specialization. One of the things that they're lacking is post-operative care. Remember that in the days following this crisis, people were performing amputations with hacksaws. There were dental students who were performing amputations with local anesthesia. They were not performed correctly. A lot of people are going to be disfigured for life, are going to be immobilized for life because of that. But post-operative care could make a great difference. A lot of these high-powered doctors who are here, and it's wonderful they've come, but they're not willing to work beneath what they consider their station. I've worked closely with some of them. I've been to the general hospital. They will not do post-operative care. What's needed here now are nurses, good post-operative care nurses who can identify problems of people who have undergone amputations. Now, of course, there is a great problem, a growing problem of disease, because there is not proper sanitation in these huge camps. There are thousands and thousands of people who are sleeping on the ground, and there is not proper sanitation. They are just forced into small areas, small tents, sometimes two families, maybe 12 people to a tent. tent, and really they're not tents. Some of them are just sheets that are held up by sticks of wood. Believe me, when the rainy season comes in March, which is not that far away, this is going to be a huge disaster.
We're speaking with Kevin Pina, special correspondent for Flashpoints on the ground in Port-au-Prince. Kevin, take us through your day. What happened today? What did you do? Where did you go? And tell us a little bit more about what you saw on the way.
Well, you know, I spent my day mostly meeting with community leaders, them asking me if I could sort of give them advice and counsel so that we could coordinate with the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, so that we could contact members of Congress, we could contact members of the Senate and the State Department, so that, again, they will change their strategy on the ground for relief aid, that they will, instead of seeing the community as something to be feared, that they require huge guns or that there's a security concern, instead working with the community, working with those leaders to begin to help them to organize amongst themselves to provide the relief aid. That is the only way that they're going to ensure against massive deaths, massive disease in these huge camps that are formed in the capital.
What will happen in the rainy season?
Well, you've got people who are sleeping on the ground, Dennis. They're going to be sleeping in mud. You're going to have hundreds of thousands of people sleeping in mud. Even if they were to relocate them, as they're proposing, to Quatabuque, which is another neighborhood to the south of the capital, even if they were to relocate them to the north to an area called Tabar next to the U.S. Embassy compound, they're still sleeping in the dirt unless they're somehow going to magically build a huge concrete foundation where people aren't forced to sleep in the mud. But come March, there are heavy rains, and when those heavy rains fall, you're going to have a lot more deaths. You're going to have a lot more disease come.
And what about what's happening in terms of the U.S. military and the United Nations? Do you see them on the ground doing the important work now, or are they still moving around in big vehicles with big guns?
They are. They're going through the streets on patrols. They're encamped in front of the banks in Pétionville, for example, in front of the banks in Chamaz. You see heavy security presence in front of all of the banks, in front of all of the important businesses of the rich inside of Pétionville. You see the U.S. Marines going in three Humvees. It seems to be their policy. Three Humvees, four soldiers per Humvee. They go in groups of 12. They come out with large guns. You see them patrolling the capital. Sometimes I saw them yesterday actually walking, a patrol of 12, walking through the streets of the Capitol. They kind of seemed a little bit confused, like they weren't quite sure what they were supposed to do, because there really wasn't anything to guard against them. They were patrolling, but it was kind of casual. But they also seemed to be very, very curious about the Haitians, and their guard was let down, quite frankly, because there really is nothing to be concerned about, despite the militarization of the process and the fact that security has taken a priority over humanitarian concerns. Even the soldiers themselves, I think, are sometimes a little bit perplexed about exactly what they're doing.
And what about the airport? Are supplies still coming in? Is the military is in control of the airport? Are supplies being distributed as they land? Are they being allowed to land? What can we say about that?
No, there is no massive distribution of aid or water at all. Again, people are suffering in so many communities. We're trying to put a list together of each of the communities. We're trying to identify how many families are in each community, how many children are in each family, how many older people are in each family. Because remember, amongst this crisis, it's the young and the elderly who are the most vulnerable and who require the immediate attention and aid. They cannot be allowed to be dehydrated. They cannot allowed to be malnourished or to suffer for lack of food. So we're doing our best to put together those lists as part of our concern to approach the authorities to, again, allow the community leaders to do what they do best, to work in their own communities, to organize the distribution of this relief aid so that people will not die, they will not suffer. There is so much more that can be done here if they would just realize there is nothing to be afraid of. We understand that it was right after that Aristide had asked to return from South Africa that the largest portion of this militarization occurred. It didn't have to be that way. They didn't have to turn back relief flights. They didn't have to turn back search and rescue crews and lose that precious week that they took taking over the airport when people were under the rubble and they could have been saved. But you know, Dennis, there is a miracle among all of this. A 16-year-old girl was found yesterday, still survived. What's today? Today is day 17. Survived under the rubble of the Caribbean market in Petionville. They found her alive. They found a 24-month-old baby 2 days ago in Montlazar in the area of the Sopidep school. Still alive, amazingly. A 4-year-old 3 days ago found alive. They could have been rescued. They could have been helped so much more quickly if the time had not been taken to secure, as they say, the capital with the U.S. Marines. So much pressure. Precious time was lost. So many precious lives were lost as a result.
We're hearing now U.S. troops have created three small artificial beaches in the Port-au-Prince Harbor to begin offloading containers. They're saying they're going to have 200 coming in, and then by next week, the end of next week, 500 containers a day.
Well, that would be great, but they can bring in as many containers as they want, but if they can't figure out how to distribute it without it being a riot, it's not going to do any good. Because, as I told you a couple of days ago, I was there in Chamas when the UN, Brazilian soldiers attempted to do a distribution of aid, and it ended up just being a riot. They shot rubber bullets at the crowd. Two people were injured for rubber bullets. They had to use tear gas. It's just absolutely preventable and not necessary if they will listen to reason and listen to the leaders of the communities who are within these camps.
So are you saying, Kevin, just to be clear, that there is already arrived there quite a bit of aid, but still it's not being distributed in a methodical way? It's not getting out to the people who need it. That's what you're saying, that because we're hearing about millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars and all kinds of groups being involved. And you're saying, but it's just there's a stopping point, and it's the airport.
It seems so, and at the wharf, it seems so. I mean, there are some civilian organizations who have also brought in aid, like the Salvation Army. I have to say, I have to compliment the Salvation Army. Their approach is a little bit closer to the community approach. They don't have the contacts, but we're going to try to get them to them so that we can begin to maybe to work together, because their approach is community-based, and, you know, I've got to give a little bit of a compliment to the Salvation Army. World Vision, which is, of course, a religious organization based out of Seattle, they're also a little bit open, more open. But USAID and the U.S. government, France and the Canadian government, they are completely closed to working with the community. They have made no outreach. And what they're waiting for is a government that was ineffective before this crisis to somehow pull out of the ashes and perform miracles. When, of course, we know that last week the Prabal government distributed tons of aid to more than 30 locales, police stations, and mayor's offices within Port-au-Prince, and none of that aid has been distributed. It's a scandal. Those mayors, those offices have kept it for themselves. Some of it is showing up in the local market being sold.
All right, so we've got the U.S. military and the United Nations guarding the banks and the various businesses of the rich. We've got the United States Marines and the U.S. military controlling the airport. And we have hundreds of thousands of people who are suffering. And you're saying that it's your belief and your witness that many, many people have died because of this policy.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any question about that. As I said, there have been some miracles in this where people have been found just in the last couple days.
Well, that's the point, though. I mean, if people were pulling them out earlier.
Found whose deaths could have been avoided had the Obama administration not decided to militarize relief aid in Haiti.
All right, final words, Kevin. What would you tell the president if you had 2 minutes with him besides, you know, a few things we can't say on the radio?
U.S. foreign policy needs to change. You cannot demonize these people, continue to demonize them because of their political choices. Jean-Bertrand Aristide was democratically elected twice and in 2004. And whereas George W. Bush, who Obama has chosen to team up with Clinton in order to cheerlead for the fundraising effort in the United States, is reviled in this country, Jean-Bertrand Aristide still remains to be a loved personage, somebody who I believe could mobilize this population. And certainly those community leaders who are part of Lavalas, part of that movement, which begrudgingly is said to be the largest political movement, begrudgingly by the U.S. press, said to be the largest political movement and political party in the country, that they should not be afraid of them, that they are willing and ready to help, they have open arms, and that they want to work together with them because the suffering needs to stop.
Friends and family, people who we've worked with, what can you say about that?
Well, my family is finally in one place, but they're in one of these camps. They sleep on the dirt. There's dust. Again, there's no food, no water, except for that which we bring them or they're able to buy with money that I give them. It's the same for thousands and thousands and thousands of families. I think everyone is searching for a place to relocate because those camps are horrible. There's not proper sanitation. You're sleeping in the dirt. The only thing that you have to cling to is your sense of family and each other, and that's a wonderful thing that Haitians have. It's part of what makes them so resilient is their strong sense of family and loyalty to family. However, you know, even that can be broken if this takes too long. People are just scrambling to get whatever money they can to relocate their own families out of those camps, because also I've got to tell you that there seems to be rumors, and we've heard here in the press, that the Preval administration, the U.S. government, have agreed that they're going to relocate them to two camps, one in Quadibouquet and one next to the U.S. embassy, and eventually they're going to force them to disperse into the provinces, into the countryside of Haiti. And remember, a lot of these families have deep ties and roots to their communities in the capital, and they don't want to leave. So that's going to create another problem eventually. And if they don't work with the community, if they don't communicate better with the people on the ground who are in those camps, they're just asking for trouble. It's only going to explode in their faces. They need to really be sensitive and listen right now.
All right, Kevin Pina, Flashpoint special correspondent on the ground for 20 years back in Port-au-Prince, trying to help organize aid and giving us information that we would not be able to get anywhere else. Kevin, obviously, it's a dangerous place to be, not because of the people, but because of the earthquake. We urge you to be careful, and please, we'll be talking to you soon.
Thank you so much, Dennis, and thank you to everyone who has supported the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund and who have supported my work directly and personally. I'll never forget it, and God bless you all.
You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now go to Honduras, to the Brazilian embassy in Honduras, where for the last 126 days, I think it is, 129 days, the exiled president, Manuel Zelaya, who was the victim of a, we have to say, U.S.-supported coup now, assisted coup, is preparing to leave, and also Andres Thomas Canteres will be leaving as well. Andres, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Dennis, it's great to be with you and Nora, and it's really going to be great to leave this embassy after these 129 days.
129 days. Well, tell us what the situation is and what's going to happen in terms of tomorrow and the president leaving.
Well, the situation involves the fact that the president's the democratically elected term is over. It ends tomorrow on January 27th. And then he has been invited to be an honored guest by the President of the Dominican Republic. That's President Leonel Fernandez. And he has accepted that invitation to leave the country. And the reason he's leaving is because there are pending charges against him by the coup regime. And the Supreme Court was very complicit in the coup itself and in the criminal charges against President Zelaya. So President Zelaya is very willing to face any of the 24 charges that his accusers have against him. However, he's only willing to do that in an independent court of law where he would receive a fair trial, and that is not at all possible at this time. So he is going to leave the country tomorrow. The plan is that he will go to the he will stay here in the embassy while the president of the Dominican Republic goes to the inauguration of Porfirio Lobo, and then President Fernandez will come here to the embassy, we understand, along with the president of Guatemala, President Colon. They will come here and escort President Zelaya from the embassy to the airport, where the resistance is going to be waiting to receive him and to bid him farewell. Thousands and thousands of people are expected to be there at the airport. There is a story about how the right-wing members of Congress here in Honduras are trying to prevent President Zelaya from leaving the country, saying that he should not have a safe conduct pass. So it will be a very interesting day tomorrow. We just had a visit here at the embassy of the Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. That's Arturo Valenzuela. This is the man who took over from Thomas Shannon. And Arturo Valenzuela came here to the embassy and met President Zelaya for the first time. And they had a cordial meeting. Mr. Valenzuela will go to the inauguration tomorrow and then return to the state. So this is concluding more than 4 months of being holed up here in the embassy. There have been serious ups and downs, from very repressive moments to times that I will remember the rest of my life, in terms of just incredible conversations with President Zelaya. He's an amazing guitar player, and there will be very fond memories.
And what... How would you characterize, I introduced this segment as a U.S.-supported and assisted coup. We have to believe, Andres, that the United States government ultimately supported the coup after it happened, if they didn't help engineer it, and they didn't do anything to re-empower President Zelaya. So what do we say about this policy?
We say that the U.S. is absolutely complicit in the coup itself and in not undoing it. It's very clear that the U.S. needed a peace agreement to be signed, but they had no interest in compliance of that accord. So as soon as the accord was signed on October 30th, Thomas Shannon, who is the predecessor of Arturo Valenzuela, who was just here, left Honduras, went back to the States, and had an interview with CNN and told them that the U.S. would respect the elections, whether President Zelaya was restored as the leader of the country or not. And that was an absolute sabotage of the accord, and then that led to the U.S. Definitely doing that exactly, which is pushing for the elections and supporting that process as a way to put the coup of President Zelaya behind them. And this, of course, this coup regime has not been recognized by any other government in the world, including the U.S. However, the successor to the coup regime, the government of Porfirio Lobo, has also been extremely complicit in the coup itself. And so this means that Death Squad Democracy will continue here in the country because the repression has been very, very intense against the resistance. And the U.S. complicity there, at a minimum, is that there is no outcry. The insults from high-level U.S. government officials, such as Hillary Clinton, who called President Zelaya reckless for returning, for wanting to return to his own country. And then there is this man, Louis Anselm, the representative at the Organization of American States. He called it foolish and irresponsible for President Zelaya to return to his country. This kind of language was never used by any U.S. official in terms of really crying out and clamoring on behalf of the victims of this intense repression that has continued all of these 7 months since the coup itself.
So this repression is continuing, and there are concerns, given that there was a landscape, if you will, or an architecture, an infrastructure that was set up many years ago by the United States government of military death squads, so that they are now fully empowered, having been able to pull off a coup.
That's exactly right. And, we've mentioned him before, Ambassador John Dimitri Negroponte, who was here in the early 80s. He was famous for becoming later on the ambassador to Iraq and taking what's called the Salvador option to Iraq. And that describes how the repression is targeted toward the support base of the resistance, not directly to the resistance itself. And that is exactly also what has been going on here in Honduras and by the people who very much were involved in that at the time, talking specifically about a man by the name of Billy Joya, who was famous for disappearing and torturing victims in the 80s. And then he has been a primary security advisor for the coup regime at this time. We also know that in the Porfirio government that is about to be sworn in tomorrow, his security official is the nephew of one of the most infamous terror-causing generals in the country, General Alvarez, trained at the School of the Americas. He was responsible for hundreds and hundreds of cases of torture, disappearance, and political assassination. And so his nephew will now be in charge of security for the upcoming government here.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Andres Canteras. He is in Honduras after 129 days in the Brazilian embassy with the president, Manuel Zelaya. They will be leaving, and I guess the president will be going to the Dominican Republic, and then he will be going to Mexico?
That's right, Dennis. He will be briefly in the Dominican Republic, where he's been invited to be a guest, but his longer-term plan is to settle more in Mexico until he can have safe passage back to his country, Honduras, and either the charges will be dropped against him or he can be assured to have a fair trial.
The day the world gets round to understanding where it is, using all it's found to help each other hand in hand.
You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we continue our remembrance of Howard Zinn with a friend of his, somebody who's worked with him on various events and various actions, Barbara Lubin from the Middle East Children's Alliance. This is a big hole in our universe, huh?
It's a big hole in our lives, in our universe, and I'm so very grateful to have had the relationship that the Middle East Children's Alliance and Penny and myself have had with Howard Zinn over the years. I was going through some papers at work, you know, after you called me, and I was remembering an event that he and Alice Walker did. I think it was KPFA in Mecca, at Saint Joe's Church, Father Bill's Church. This was many years ago. It was when Howard Zinn's book, his autobiography, came out. And it's called You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train. And I remember getting up and giving this wonderful introduction and saying how wonderful his new book, You Can't Be Neutered on a Moving Train, was, and how hysterical both he and I became laughing. And it was one of those moments.
It's a good Freudian.
Yeah, maybe you can be. But, you know, I thought when you asked me to come here, I just thought there were a few things that I thought about, and I thought about the things that Howard has said over the years. And I just thought I'd like to say a few of them.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes.
And the big event that we did with Howard was the People's History of the United States. And it was an amazing, amazing event. It was in 2006. And it was with Alice Walker and Mose Def and so many wonderful people. But we, in the introduction of this event, we had written a quote of Howard's. It said, "To omit or to minimize these voices of resistance is to create the idea that power only rests with those who have guns, who possess the wealth, who own the newspapers and the television stations. I want to point out that people who seem to have no power, whether working people, people of color, or women, once they organize and protest and create movements, have a voice no government can suppress." And that was really what Howard's work was about. It was letting all of us know that if we stand up, if we speak out, we can take power. We can wrestle it away from these other people who don't care about poor people, people who are hurting, people with disabilities. And I found all of these things that Howard had said, and I'll just quickly run through a couple of them because I know you don't have much time, and I wanted to finish by speaking Howard's voice at his wife's funeral. He said, "In war, good guys always become bad guys." How true that is. And then he said, "If you don't know history, it's as if you were born yesterday. What matters most is not who is sitting in the White House, but who is sitting in and who is marching outside the White House for change. Protest beyond the law is not a departure from democracy. It is absolutely essential to it." And then one of my favorites was, if the gods had intended for people to vote, they would have given us candidates." And "The memory of oppressed people is one thing that cannot be taken away. And for such people with such memories, revolt is always an inch below the surface." And
that's Barbara Lubin. We're remembering Howard Zinn, who died earlier today at 87 in California.
And in 2008, his wife, Roz, died. And Howard and Roz were a couple that lived together for about, I think it was about 65 years. And she was an artist. She was an activist. She was as magnificent a woman as Howard was a man. They were quite the couple. Wonderful, wonderful people. And at her funeral, Howard gave some remarks, and he said, "Her gift, Roz's gift to us, courage, kindness, a glimpse of how people might be in a better world. My sadness is indescribable, but I keep reminding myself how lucky I am to have been married for 63 years to a woman whose beauty, body, and soul have always filled me with awe. Our love for one another, our friendship, our passion never diminished through all those years." How many of us in the listening audience and here in the station could even think that way or speak that way or have lived a life like that?
Tender and tough.
And here was Zinn, the man who rewrote the history as it should have been written, who awakened all of us to what was happening in the world and what we should do about it. And there he was in this beautiful, tender relationship. And then he said at the very end, lying in bed, Roz was concerned about me. Would I have enough to eat? Would I be able to take care of myself? I wrote to our friend Alice Walker about Roz and said, you're in California. You don't need to come to the memorial. Alice wrote back and said, I'm coming. I love you and Roz with all my heart, as you know. Can't wait to hold you and remind you that she's not gone anywhere. I feel her and always see how her wonderful, luminous face and loving smile. Roz's smile made the plants grow. And Howard said, I'm comforted by what Alice said. Yes, Roz's spirit is still here, her gift to us, courage, kindness, a glimpse of how people might be in a better world.
Barbara Lubin, remembering Howard Zinn, 87, passed away earlier today. Barbara, thank you for coming in. We're out of time.
Thanks for having me, Dennis.
That was beautiful.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue to honor the life and work of historian and anti-war activist Howard Zinn, who passed away yesterday in Southern California at the age of 87. In one moment, we'll be joined by Howard Zinn's friend, colleague, and co-editor, Anthony Arnove. But first, we go to the short tribute produced by KPFA's Esther Mania.
I was a politically aware young person reading about fascism and the Spanish Civil War and Hitler and Mussolini. And so I wanted to go. I wanted to go fight against fascism. So I
volunteered for the Air Force.
I was in the Air Force for 2.5 years and dropped bombs on Berlin, dropped bombs on various cities in Germany, and even bombed a little town in France. And this was a strange one, and one that had a very profound effect on me later as I thought about it. And the war actually in Europe was about over. It was a few weeks from being over, and everybody knew it. They told us we were going to bomb this little town in France because there were several thousand German soldiers around the town. They weren't doing anything, they weren't bothering anyone, they were just waiting for the war to end. But we were going to go over and bomb them. Of course, later I learned this was napalm, the first use of napalm in the European theater. And you know, when you're bombing from 30,000 feet, you don't hear anything, you don't see anything, you don't know what's happening to people down there, you don't hear people screaming, you don't see blood, you don't see mangled limbs, none of that. Several thousand people were killed. Germans were killed, French were killed, and it wasn't until really after the war, maybe after I learned about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and began to think about bombing and began to question the total goodness of the good war, only then did I go think about Royan and that bombing.
Sleeping on a pillow of solid rock.
I thought about my own experience in the Air Force, and it was very clear to me, looking around at all these guys around me who were dropping bombs and who were killing people, that did not come from inside. It did not come from, oh God, how good it would be to kill some people today. You know, there was no urge to kill, even though they were the enemy. No, what it came from was simply we had been trained. And also we had been told it's a good war. We had been told we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. Wars don't take place out of the rush of a population demanding war. It isn't the population that demands war, it's the leaders who demand war and who prepare the population for war.
Well, there's a fight against the blood and hatred in the air.
So it then became very important for me to knock down argue against that idea whenever I could.
A lot of people are troubled by civil disobedience. As soon as you talk about committing civil disobedience, they get a little upset. That's exactly the purpose of civil disobedience. To upset people, to trouble them, to disturb them. We who commit civil disobedience are disturbed too, and we mean to disturb those who are in charge of the war. And so, let the spirit of disobedience spread to the war factories, to the battlefield, to the halls of Congress, every town and city, until the killing stops, until we can hold up our heads again before the world. Because our children deserve a world without war, and we ought to try to give them that.
Voices of the people have been overlooked in the traditional history books. We didn't want to hear the words of the people in the White House. We wanted to hear the words of people who were picketing the White House. Agitators, the anti-war protesters, the socialists and anarchists. In other words, the people who gave us whatever liberty and democracy we have in this country.
We should be questioning the larger principle involved, and that is, should the United States be sending troops anywhere in the world, whether it's Afghanistan, Iraq, or anywhere else, should we think we can solve any problems with military solutions? The Iraqis don't want us in Iraq, that's clear. The American people don't want us in Iraq. It's a continuation of the whole idea of U.S. Military dominance in the world, which we should do everything we can to bring to an end.
Democracy is in dissent. Democracy is in resistance. Democracy doesn't come from the top, it comes from the bottom.
For only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love in here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality.
Come on, talk. The words of Howard Zinn, who passed away yesterday at the age of 87. We're now joined by Anthony Arnov, who is a writer, literary agent, and the co-editor with Zinn of Voices of the People's History of the United States, and who has spent the last few years producing live stage readings of this incredible compilation of the speeches, letters, and documents by this country's greatest revolutionaries, dissidents, protesters, and the outspoken critics of the establishment of war and of obedience to both. Anthony Arnov, thank you so much for being with us. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with Howard Zinn and what his legacy means right now at this time we're in today?
Well, thanks, Nora, for talking about Howard's legacy and really doing so much to keep it alive. You know, like you and so many other people, my first encounter with Howard Zinn was through The People's History of the United States, and reading that book, I was around 18 at the time, and, you know, having it change fundamentally how I thought about my life, how I thought about the world, how I saw my political responsibilities, how I saw so many things. You know, before I had read A People's History of the United States, history was totally alien to me. You know, it was something that spoke in no way to my experience or my concerns. And then Howard created this completely different way of looking at the world, looking at history from the bottom up as something active, as something ordinary people made and had a responsibility to be part of making. And I was very lucky years later to work at a publishing house in Boston, South End Press, where Howard had a connection. South End had published his play Emma, about Emma Goldman. And through South End Press, I came to know Howard and had the opportunity to work with him first on his play, Marx in Soho, which I helped publish and then tour and produce with the actor Brian Jones and Howard, and that led to a book of interviews we did together called Terrorism and War. And out of that experience, this book that you mentioned, Voices, which not only then led to these live performances, but also a documentary that people speak that, you know, I'm just so thrilled I could work on, and that Howard could see air on televisions and see, you know, really fulfill a lifelong project before this really shocking passing of Howard yesterday.
Howard consistently demanded people to question the status quo, to question the establishment, to question, you know, the perceived history of this country, the history that, as you mentioned, was written in the books, but which left out the voices of the indigenous, the enslaved, the poor, the struggling, the working class. He had uncompromising passion for truth and justice and wit and humility. What will you miss the most about him as a friend and as a colleague? And how will he be remembered by not only his family and friends and colleagues, but by the world, by the millions who read and continue to read his books?
Well, you know, I think you touched on it when you said wit. Howard's sense of humor was just unparalleled. You know, he had, even in the darkest circumstances, even when dealing with the most serious political topics, even when dealing, you know, with the ups and downs and the depressing moments of struggle, he had a joy. He had an ability to find humor. He had an ability to appreciate the culture, the art, the life of protest and dissent. And he made a life of protest, a life of struggle, seem like the most meaningful, the most important, the most vital way one could be a human being on this planet. And it was infectious, and it inspired so many people to dedicate their lives to fighting for justice, to being part of social movements, you know, and that legacy is going to live on in so many different ways. There are so many people for whom a Howard Zinn lecture or article or book was the turning point, the moment when they changed their lives and became active and became part of social movements. And those people are not going to give up the fight, and they're going to carry that spirit into so many different struggles. And so, you know, that is, it's very encouraging and very inspiring that one person could have that impact. One kind of exemplary individual could bring about so much change.
That's the voice of Anthony Arnove, and we're talking about the life and legacy of Howard Zinn. You know, and Howard was, as you were, instrumental in both the live stage performance of Voices of People's History and also, of course, within the People Speak, the documentary that aired recently on the History Channel. Any plans yet to continue the live stage version of this book?
Well, there's ongoing readings that we've set up to happen in schools and communities and neighborhoods around the country through a nonprofit that we set up together called Voices of a People's History of the United States. Our model in many ways is what Eve Ensler has done with her play Vagina Monologues and her organization V-Day. And so we hope those readings will go on and will happen for many, many years to come and keep alive that tradition of dissent and protest. And then the documentary, The People Speak, is coming out on DVD. There's a music soundtrack. There'll be all kinds of online materials. And in our age, which is increasingly visual, it's a significant legacy, and I hope it will be something that really preserves Howard's voice and his vision for future generations.
All right. Well, keep us posted on that, definitely. Anthony Arnove, on behalf of the Flashpoints team and our listeners, we're so sorry about Howard's passing, but we know that his legacy will live on in you and in all of us. Thank you so much for all that you continue to do.
Thank you, Nora.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and The Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.